We have some really noted experts to speak on this subject today. I would like to start out first by also adding a word of thanks to the Dean and to the Virginia Law School Foundation. They've really made an effort to support student initiatives to enhance the intellectual life of the law school, and they have provided some important support for this symposium today. I'm going to introduce here together our three speakers in the order in which they will speak. We will certainly be reserving some time for question and answer at the end. The overall topic, I should just note, the topic is so important that it merits actually two subtitles. The one that Lisa did not mention is the constitutional status of Puerto Rico and our other insular territories. Each of the people who will be speaking to us today has written and spoken on this topic in many different venues. Our first speaker will be the Honorable Juan Torroella, who is a Puerto Rican jurist and a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, where he has served since 1984. He ascended to that position after 10 years as a federal district court judge in the District of Puerto Rico. Judge Torroella holds a degree from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. He received his law degree from Boston University School of Law, and he holds three master's degrees from the University of Puerto Rico, from Oxford University, and from the University of Virginia. He was here as part of our master's program for judges, and his master's thesis here was later published as a book titled The Supreme Court in Puerto Rico, The Doctrine of Separate and Unequal, which is a study of the Supreme Court's decisions in the insular cases. Very honored to have Judge Torroella with us today. Our second speaker is Professor Roger Smith. He is the Christopher H. Brown Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He received his undergraduate education at Michigan State. He got his PhD from Harvard University in 1980 and then joined the faculty at Yale University, where he eventually became the Alfred Cowles Professor of Government. In 2001, he moved to his present distinguished professorship at the University of Pennsylvania. Roger Smith and I have been on a few panels together. He is an original thinker, a prolific author in the fields of political theory, legal studies, and American history. I'm just going to mention one of his works that's particularly relevant to the topic today. That's a book called Civic Ideals, Conflicting Visions of Citizenship in U.S. History, which was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in History in 1998. Our third speaker is Christina Duffy Burnett, who is joining the law faculty at Columbia University effective this summer. She has a BA in History and Latin American Studies from Princeton and is now completing a PhD there at Princeton. She also holds a law degree from Yale and an MPhil from Cambridge University. In the midst of all that academic work, she has also found time to be a law clerk to the Honorable Jose Cabranes of the Second Circuit, who is the second Puerto Rican after Judge Torroella to be named a U.S. Court of Appeals judge, and also for Justice Stephen Breyer. Her scholarship examines the constitutional and international legal history of American empire, and a couple of her noted works would be an article published in the University of Chicago Law Review called Untied States, American Expansion and Territorial De-Annexation, which is a revisionist interpretation of the insular cases. And she also co-edited a volume with Burke Marshall, a collection of essays called Foreign in a Domestic Sense, a rather unusual phrase right out of one of the insular cases, Foreign in a Domestic Sense, Puerto Rico, American Expansion, and the Constitution. Please welcome our three panelists. We'll hear first from Judge Torroella.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for inviting me to be here with you today. My remarks will be divided in three parts. I don't know for sure that I will get to all three of them, but as soon as my wife moves her glasses, I know my time is up. The insular cases cannot really be understood properly without a historical background as to how they were decided, how the world was in the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, because they are part, very much part of it. particularly part of our constitutional history at that time. So that will be my the first part of my remarks. The second part, I will try to cover the insular cases in a very brief fashion, basically what they stand for. And the last part I will try to get to is the present import of this doctrine, which is very much alive today, and what it means, I think, to the United States, not only nationally, but also internationally. The German military theorist Clausewitz said, and I paraphrase, that war is a continuation of politics by other means. I pose to you that all of us as students of the law, this is a we can have a logical progression between this politics and war. We can also observe this relationship that exists between politics and the law, particularly between politics and public law, and especially between politics and constitutional law. And I think there are a few scenarios that are more cogently illustrate this proposition than that presented by the Supreme Court decisions in the insular cases and the progeny. Now, we generally, there's disputes as to what are the insular cases, but there are at least five original ones, and then the progeny will go all the way forward to, I think, the present day. I think that we see some of the Supreme Court cases dealing with the military detention facilities in Guantanamo. We'll see some reference to the doctrine of the insular cases. In my opinion, the insular cases display some of the most notable examples in the history of the Supreme Court in which its decisions interpreting the Constitution evidence an unabashed reflection of contemporaneous politics. The insular cases, in effect, translated the political dispute about the acquisition of foreign territories into the vocabulary of the Constitution, with the Supreme Court eventually echoing the popular sentiment of the day. Other conspicuous instances of this assertion that come to mind, and which coincidentally are also intimately related to the insular cases, and which I will touch upon briefly, are Plessy versus Ferguson, and of course the follow-up in Brown versus Board of Education. When the insular cases are placed in the historical context, it becomes self-evident that they represent a constitutional law extension of the Spanish-American War of 1898 and the imperialist slash manifest destiny causes which that conflict promoted. That war, in effect, was a culmination of a national expansionist process that commenced almost from the day that the War for Independence ended in 1783, and which proceeded thereafter in a predictable progression by the acquisition of, by various means, of the continental lands that were contiguous to the United States, in its various configurations, of course. It was a process that climaxed with the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848 that ended the Mexican War, which resulted in the annexation of all our western and southwestern states. And these additions in territory within the continent proper consolidated our present-day contours of the United States and our borders with Mexico and Canada. Nevertheless, the political forces that had promoted the expansion from sea to shining sea were still restless, and they looked for further growth in the two geographical areas of most obvious interest to the United States, the Caribbean and the Pacific. A moribund Spanish Empire presented tantalizing targets of opportunity, and thus the splendid little war, known to us as the Spanish-American War, came to being, and the new additions to the American Empire proceeded thereafter. There were, however, important differences between the territorial acquisitions that preceded the Spanish-American War as compared to those that were annexed as a result of that clash. The first was, of course, geographical, in that these new territories, namely Puerto Rico, the Philippine Islands, and Guam, were non-contiguous. In fact, were separated from the mainland by considerable oceanic differences. Now, as soon as I make that statement, I have to make certain comments, because it is not totally accurate. Because Alaska, which had been purchased from Russia in 1867, although technically part of the mainland, was not physically connected to the United States proper. And by 1898, we had resolved our differences with England, and so therefore Alaska was not contiguous to the United States in the Northwest. And in the case of Hawaii, however, we have a very similar situation, and you'll see presently why I'm referring so much to Alaska and Hawaii, because they have a lot to do with the insular cases. The case of Hawaii, however, was much closer to the situation with the Spanish islands that, first of all, Hawaii was an island several thousand miles away from the mainland. Furthermore, its annexation by the United States was almost contemporaneous with the Spanish-American War, taking place as a result of the Newland Resolution in July 7, 1898, right in the middle of the Spanish-American War. However, there are other factors in the case of both Alaska and Hawaii which distinguish them from the Spanish-American War acquisitions. In the case of the Spanish island of Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Guam, there were almost no United States citizens residing therein when the change in sovereignty took place. And sub silentio, but perhaps most importantly in the real politics of the times, much, if not most, of the large native populations inhabiting these islands were non-white. Thus, for the first time in the history of the United States, we acquired sovereignty over lands that were separated by thousands of miles from the political and economic epicenter of the American polity, and which were inhabited by large numbers of subject people who were of different races and had other languages, cultures, religions, and legal systems than those of the dominant Anglo-Saxon society that prevailed in the United States at the time. Equally important was the principal, if unannounced, reason for these territorial expansions, the economic exploitation of these new territories by the ruling metropolis. With these set of facts in place, what we had was the basic ingredients of a typical European colonial relationship of the late 19th century. Thus, it is not surprising that the ruling groups of the times looked to European colonial solutions for these new American imperial relationships. Nevertheless, since it was for use by America, to whom, for historical reasons, the term colonialism was anathema, the answer to this conundrum had to be cloaked in American constitutional mantle of facial respectability, and the de facto colonial status had to be validated by a legal regime that would de jure allow the United States to govern the new lands and their people with a free hand untethered by the constitutional constraints that normally restrained the structures in the continental United States. To this purpose, there came to the aid of the political branches the think tanks of the epoch, principally at Harvard University and also Yale, and thus emerged the ideological underpinnings of the insular cases and the dogma, which I have elsewhere referred to as the doctrine of separate and unequal. The academic groping for a plausible justification for the retention and governance of the new island territories first came to light in a series of articles published in 1898 and 99 in the Harvard Law Review. And if you read these articles, you'll see the precursors of the theories that come out in the actual insular cases. The first, and I'm not going to go into the details of these articles, I'll just briefly mention. The first one was one by Carmen Randall. And he argued, relying on two Supreme Court cases, one decided by Chief Justice Marshall, Longboro v. Blake, in which the issue in that case is exactly the same case as the principal case decided by the Supreme Court in Downs later, the main insular case, Downs versus Bidwell. The issue there was they were trying to tax, put a direct tax on the District of Columbia, and the objection was the uniformity clause in the Constitution. And And the issue, of course, was whether you, the Constitution applied to the District of Columbia, which is a territory. That is exactly the precise question that came up in Dobbs versus Bidwell later on. Justice Marshall said, and I quote, "Does the term United States designate the whole or a particular portion of the American Empire? Certainly, this question can admit but to one answer. It is the name given our great republic, which is composed of states and territories. The District of Columbia, or territory west of the Missouri, is not less within the United States than Maryland or Pennsylvania, and thus the Constitution applies." The next case is the Dred Scott case, which unfortunately we all know is an infamous case for other reasons. But the issue there also involved whether Congress, by the use of the territorial clause, could legislate and abolish slavery or abolish slavery in the territory of Missouri. We know that the answer to that question led to the Civil War, but leaving that issue aside, Chief Justice Taney stated that there was no power in the Constitution under the territorial clause for Congress to legislate except within the powers of the Constitution as to the territories. And there's no power is given to acquire a territory to be held and governed in a permanently colonial character. That's one of the points that he makes. Then another one of the articles is more in tune with what actually happened when these cases came to the Supreme Court. Professor Thayer said, "America should not forget her precedence of teaching nations how to live. Let me once and surely say that in my judgment, there is no lack of power in our nation of legal constitutional power to govern these islands as colonies substantially as England might govern." Well, that's pretty much what the Supreme Court did. The insular case has come about because after the Spanish-American War ends, there is a need to establish civil government in these islands. Furthermore, there's a need to provide the money to run that civil government. So Congress passes the Foraker Act. And the Foraker Act does two things. It establishes a civil government for Puerto Rico, and it also establishes the taxation, raising money by way of a tax of imports and exports into the United States from Puerto Rico. And of course, it was not uniform, and therefore it was challenged as not being constitutional. The first case, I'll only mention in detail two cases. The first case basically decides that Puerto Rico was part of the United States for purposes of this tax. Therefore, it was not a foreign nation, and therefore the law applied to that extent. The second case, which is the most important one, which is the Dobbs versus Bidwell, the issue there is exactly whether this statute, the Foraker Act, is valid under the Uniformity Clause. Shortly before these cases are decided in 1901, the first five cases are issued on May 27, 1901. They will all argue within 1 week. There are several things I would like to mention about this court. One is that with the exception of one of the justices, they were all the same justices that had sat on the Plessy Court. I think that is a relevant point because to me it shows that the judges were willing to read beyond the letter of the Constitution to basically I hate to use this word when I refer to justices of the Supreme Court, but I can't say anything else. I think they invented several of these theories, whole cloth, and I think the political times had something to do with it. The election of 1901 had just been held in the United States, in which McKinley, the president of the United States during the Spanish-American War, had run on a ticket, which validated, for the purpose of basically validating the acquisitions of the Spanish islands. And he won by a clear majority, and I think that had something to do with the outcome of the cases. In fact, one of the political pundits of the time said the Supreme Court doesn't read the election results. It may be a little sarcastic, but I think they had he was to the point. The other point that I would like to make as to the insular cases is that particularly the first five ones, there was no clear majority except as to one. All the other cases were decided 5-1. And the main case of Downs versus Bidwell, which, as I pointed out to you, the issue was the validity of this particular statute. There was no clear majority. The five votes were for holding that the statute was valid for various and different reasons. The only opinion that received four votes was a dissent by Justice Fuller. Justice Fuller was of the opinion that Longborough, the case that I have discussed before, was valid and binding on the court. One of the opinions of the majority, of that of White, is the opinion that eventually becomes the leading doctrine of the insular cases, the doctrine of incorporation. And that opinion is based on a ruling to the effect that what determined the rights applicable in the territories was the treaty of acquisition. In the case of Puerto Rico, the treaty of acquisition said nothing about granting rights to the citizens of Puerto Rico or the other territories, but it was to be left to be determined by Congress at a future date. And to the majority judges, that meant that the territory of Puerto Rico and the other ones had not been incorporated into the United States. That had been the case prior to the Spanish-American War. Two cases come to mind after that: the case of Rasmussen, the case of Manchiki. One dealt with Hawaii, and the other one dealt with Alaska. I need a little bit of water. I don't know what I did with mine. Thank you. Running out of. Thank you. In both of those cases, the Supreme Court concludes that the treaties of acquisition had granted citizenship to the citizens, to the inhabitants of Hawaii and Alaska. And on that basis, on the basis of the granting of citizenship, they conclude that both of those territories had been incorporated, and therefore the Constitution applied. The next point is the Jones Act of 1917. The Jones Act of 1917 is the result of 22 different bills presented to Congress from 1901 through 1917, offering citizenship to the inhabitants of Puerto Rico. And 1917 is finally granted in the Jones Act, which not only grants status to the inhabitants of Puerto Rico, but also creates a new framework for the local government in which both houses of the legislature are elected in Puerto Rico, et cetera, et cetera. The main thing, as far as we're concerned, however, is that this bill, considering what had been done in Manchiki and in Rasmussen, the inhabitants of Puerto Rico concluded that now that they were citizens, that they had been incorporated into the United States, and they were entitled to the application of the Constitution. There are unfortunately to be, that would not be the case. In 1922, we have another case that some people refer to as the final insular case, which is People versus Balzac. Balzac was an editor of a newspaper in a little town of Arecibo, Puerto Rico, who published an article which was considered by the then governor of Puerto Rico as being criminally libelous, and he filed criminal libel charges, and Mr. Balzac was charged. And he claimed that now that the Constitution applied to Puerto Rico, he was entitled to be tried before a petit jury. Well, the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Chief Justice Taft, who had been president previous to that of the United States, decided that that was not to be the case. And he dispatched rather quickly of the proposition that Manchiki and Rasmussen were applicable. As to Rasmussen particularly, I would like to just refer to that because this is how he answered the grantee of citizenship and what it meant as far as the rights of the inhabitants of Puerto Rico. He said, what additional rights did it give them? It enabled them to move into continental United States and become residents of any state and enjoy every right of any other citizen in the United States. In Puerto Rico, however, Puerto Ricans cannot insist upon the right of trial by jury. The citizens living there enjoy the right. It is locality that is determinative of the application of the Constitution in such a matter as judicial procedure and the status of the people. Alaska was a very different thing from Puerto Rico. It was an enormous territory, very sparsely settled, and offering opportunity for immigration by the American citizens. It was on the American continent, within each easy reach. Of course, he doesn't even mention the situation with Hawaii. The Manchiki case is not even mentioned in that opinion. And if you want to look at how this doctrine is applied in a double standard, we come to then the two cases that that are decided by the Supreme Court immediately after the Second World War, the Kinsella case and the Colbert case. These are two accompanying civilian wives of U.S. servicemen, one in Hawaii, one in Japan, and one in London, who proceeded to murder their husbands and are charged under the provisions that then were in effect of the Military Code of Justice, and they were tried before a courts martial and were found guilty. They're brought back to the United States and they file habeas corpuses. And at that time, the case goes up to the Supreme. Both cases go up to the Supreme Court, and Justice Clark rules that rights for the majority. And holds that the insular cases, that these are trials that take place outside the United States, and of course they're not entitled to trial by jury. And he cites the insular cases. It was such a public uproar that the Supreme Court granted a rehearing, and the result, of course, was a reversal. And the majority, which is written by Black, says the insular cases can be distinguished from the present case in that they involve the power of Congress to provide rules and regulations to govern temporarily territories with wholly dissimilar traditions. Whereas here, meaning those cases, the basis for governmental power is American citizenship. Of course, the Puerto Ricans were already American citizens too when Balzac was decided. Well, he says, it is our judgment that neither those cases nor their reasoning should be given any further expansion. My last comments, I'm sure even though my wife hasn't shown it, I'm sure I've run out of time already. I would just like to make reference to present day status of this situation. I think my biggest problem at this present time is with the fact that I believe that the United States is in clear violation of not only the Constitution, but also the treaties that we have entered into, which of course are the law of the land. And I would just, every time I read this part of the Constitution, I shake my head. All treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws to the contrary, notwithstanding. We have three, at least four, treaties or conventions in which we are bound to treat all our citizens in an equal manner. And they are the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the American Declaration of Human Rights, the Inter-American Democratic Charter of the Organization of the American States, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. This last one, by the way, not only requires that we recognize equality among our citizens, but that if our constitutional system and our laws at present require them to be changed so that those rights are recognized and enforced, that we have to at least make the attempt to carry out these constitutional amendments or legislation. Not only have we not done anything in that respect, but in fact the government of the United States has actively opposed the attempts by citizens of the United States in the courts to correct this situation. And of course, I'm sorry to say, the courts of the United States have refused to enforce these treaties, notwithstanding that they are the law of the land, and that the Constitution directs them to comply with their mandate. The Supreme Court has created a political ghetto in the territories, from which there is no escape or solution by the inhabitants because they lack the political power to influence the political institutions that can make the necessary changes to the situation. Puerto Rico's United States citizens have no effective way of influencing the political branches of the national government where all the fundamental decisions affecting them are made. Thus, the judicial argument that these are issues that must be resolved through, quote, political means, end quote, is flawed ab initio. It is a flagrant subterfuge to avoid taking the action that has been sanctioned by the Supreme Court as appropriate when extreme circumstances are presented of a pervasive deficit in the democratic processes. This is the case of the United States territories, who are faced with a refusal of the political branches to correct the abuse of a discrete group of citizens that is completely under the sovereignty of the United States. For over 100 years of this colonial situation, this should be sufficient evidence of this insufferable truth. The Supreme Court, as in Plessy, should step forward to correct the wrong it created. Thank you. I'm sorry I've overstayed.
thanks to David Martin for his introduction, Lisa Perez for the invitation to come. It's a great delight for me to see Lisa and Tim, who are students of mine at Penn, as well as other familiar faces here, and to be on this panel with Christina Burnett, whom I've known since she was a dazzling Yale Law student, and with Judge Torruella, whose work I've drawn on, and so you'll see some parallels in the presentation. I didn't realize the work I drew on had originated as a master's thesis here. So, and thanks to all of you. I speak as a political scientist, and my argument is that to understand the place of the insular cases in Puerto Rico in the American political system, it's important to recognize that the United States began as simultaneously an anti-imperialist political project and an imperialist political project. It has been both anti-imperialist in some regards and imperialist in others ever since, in an unbroken line right up to the present day, though it had periods when it embraced imperialism more explicitly than others, including the period we focus on today. It began as an anti-imperialist political project because the European descendant settlers were, in the Revolution, throwing off their status as colonists of Britain. But at the same time, they were seeking to displace the indigenous tribes and govern them as subject peoples through a kind of imperial rule, and to use African slave labor made available by the slave trade instituted by imperial European nations with whom they cooperated. Now, this combination of anti-imperialism and pro-imperialism made perfect political sense in the revolutionary period, as both policies served the interests of the European descended settler population of what became the new nation. But there was always an ideological dissonance between these elements of their political projects. Because the revolution lacked clear justification in British law, the revolutionaries justified their opposition to British colonial rule by appeal to doctrines of universal individual natural rights and the legitimacy of republican self-governance. But they didn't want to extend those rights or that self-governance to members of the native tribes or the imported African slaves, and so they justified the subjugation of these groups by appeal to religious, cultural, and racial doctrines, proclaiming their own superiority as Christian whites. Nonetheless, they still faced a problem of reconciling the talk of universal individual rights with their practices of imperial governance and the doctrines defending that. And increasingly over time, during the 19th century, they tried to knit these ideological elements together by providing the argument that there are lower cultures and lower races that are not yet prepared for self-governance or full possession of individual rights, and they can be properly governed in a kind of tutelage that will, over time, lift them as high as they prove able to go, maybe all the way to equal citizenship and full participation in self-governance, though probably not, was the prevailing view. Lift them some, but maybe equality down the road, probably not. Notions of the U.S. as a kind of tutelary empire grew particularly in the late 19th and early 20th century, in the period of the insular cases, fed by a number of factors. One's been alluded to. The Civil War ended slavery, led to the Reconstruction Amendments proclaiming equal rights, but then that promise was defeated by the rise of the Jim Crow segregation system that included separate but equal schools that were defended as a kind of tutelage until the freed African-American population was sufficiently prepared for full citizenship, which, again, some thought might never come. But that was accompanied in the late 19th century by the Dawes Act, which broke up the remaining native tribal lands to a considerable extent so the land could be acquired by white settlers. But it was accompanied by efforts of tutelage to prepare the members of the tribes to be eventually U.S. citizens. So again, a kind of tutelary justification. And indeed, even in regard to the southern and eastern immigration of the late 19th century, which provided cheap labor that helped make possible the American Industrial Revolution, that made the United States gave it the potential to be a great power in the world for the first time, this immigration sparked xenophobia and anxieties, nativism, and one of the results was the spread of a public educational system designed for working class people, especially immigrant workers, that was to be a kind of tutelary vocational education, preparing them for factory jobs and maybe, you know, instilling good Protestant values and eventually preparing them for equal citizens, although, again, that wasn't anticipated to happen soon. And one reason is that in the late 19th century, all these political practices were reinforced intellectually by the rise of Darwinian evolutionary perspectives that gave new intellectual scientific credibility to the notion that humanity is divided into different races, some more advanced and some less advanced. And these events converged at the turn of the century. Those who really believed these kinds of racial doctrines and who were also excited about the fact that the United States was becoming a great economic power in the world, many of them wanted the United States to take its place amongst the great political powers of the world, to become not just a domestic empire, as it had always been in relation to the native tribes, but an overseas empire. And this was to be, this wasn't driven by sharp, immediate economic or even political necessities, but it was an ambition to prove that America was a great nation and indeed a master race. Theodore Roosevelt, in championing the Spanish and American War, said, "All the great masterful races have been fighting races. No triumph of peace is quite so great as the triumphs of war." So they knew to get an oversized empire, they'd need a war, but it was good to have a war. It would prove that we were a great race. And so we had this splendid little war, as it was called, the Spanish-American War, initiated through aggression by the United States. But unfortunately, among America's elites in those days, the acceptance of racial doctrines was so pervasive that the opposition as well as the support for the Spanish-American War was articulated heavily in these kinds of late 19th century racist terms. There were those who opposed the war because they didn't want these mongrel races, as they were called, brought into American white republic, but that side lost. The winners said that this was part of America becoming a great nation, and in so doing, they overtly embraced the picture of the U.S. as an imperial nation with colonies, probably more fully than at any other time in our history. It's true that subsequently, and in other periods too, you can find an evasiveness about using the term colonies in law. But actually, it was used openly as a good thing in the Spanish-American War period by many elites. That war did lead to the debates over the Spanish-American War acquisitions and their constitutional status that you've heard described, some arguing whether or not they had been in favor of the acquisitions, that the Constitution follows the flag and the Bill of Rights have to be extended fully to the new acquisitions. The imperialists, who favored a racially justified tutelary empire, they insisted that was not true, that it was perfectly permissible for the U.S. government to govern populations without extending them equal rights. They argued, the defenders of the imperial policy argued, that at the time of the Declaration of Independence, 80% of the U.S. population had been governed without equal rights, and so there were plenty of precedents for the U.S. To do this. And the way that these themes of still professing doctrines of individual rights and Republican self-governance, but claiming that these were consistent with tutelary rule and denials of equal rights to non-white, non-Christian peoples, or non-white peoples in this instance in particular. The way these arguments are made is well summarized in a passage I like to read in order to make clear the rhetoric of the time, unfamiliar to us now, but it's important for you to understand that this was the prevailing discourse during the course of the congressional debate over what to do with the Spanish-American War colonies. Albert Beveridge, junior senator from Indiana, first-term senator, and someone who would later be chair of the Progressive Party when it nominated Roosevelt in 1912, he said on the question of the status of the new colonies that this question is deeper than any question of party politics, deeper than any question of the isolated policy of our country even, deeper even than any question of constitutional power. It is elemental. It is racial. God has not been preparing the English-speaking and Teutonic peoples for 1,000 years for nothing but vain and idle self-contemplation and self-admiration. No, he has made us the master organizers of the world to establish a system where chaos reigns. He has given us the spirit of progress to overwhelm the forces of reaction throughout the earth. He has made us adepts in government that we may administer government among savage and senile peoples. Were it not for such a force as this, the world would relapse into barbarism and night. And of all our race, he has marked the American people as his chosen nation to finally lead in the regeneration of the world. This is the divine mission of America, and it holds for us all the profit, all the glory, all the happiness possible to man. We are trustees of the world's progress, guardians of its righteous peace. The judgment of the master is upon us. Ye have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. This speech was met with thundering applause from the Senate galleries. It was heralded in newspapers around the country, and the junior senator from Indiana was put on the committee to decide the fate of the colonies, where his policy prevailed. They would not have the Bill of Rights constitutional guarantees extended to them. And you see the claim is self-governance, human rights, yes, but we extend them through our tutelary governance of those not capable for them, and this is our divine mission. The argument of Beveridge was translated into the kinds of constitutional rulings that emerge in the insular cases in the ways you've just heard described, but I also want to add an intermediate element to that story, and not just because it involves a political scientist, but because I think it is a crucial part of the story. The judge mentioned the articles in the Harvard Law Review, but they were preceded by an article in the Atlantic Monthly by the political scientist A. Lawrence Lowell, later president of Harvard and the guy who went after Sacco and Vanzetti. The Lowell wrote an article called The Colonial Expansion of the United States in the Atlantic Monthly, where he made arguments about what to do about these colonies, and he used that term unabashedly. He said that if you look at U.S. history, its westward expansion made it one of the greatest and most successful colonizing powers the world has ever known. And this is, he says, because the Anglo-Saxon race is expansive. And he said, with our new overseas acquisitions, now we had the choice of whether they would be governed according to the theory that all men are politically equal. And he said, we must remember that the U.S. has never followed this theory. It hasn't been followed it in regard to Native Americans or blacks. He says that in the past, American governments claim that those groups didn't get rights because they are not men. He called that argument one of the many illustrations of the political good sense and bad logic of the English-speaking race. You know, they were men, but really they shouldn't have been extended rights. So it was good sense, even if it was a bad argument. But he needed new arguments, and he acknowledged that these were a problem for him because in his youth, he had supported the project of Reconstruction and equal rights embodied in the 14th and 15th Amendments. But, he said, he had come to understand that political egalitarianism should be applied, in his words, rigorously only to our own race and to those people whom we can assimilate rapidly. So the post-war amendments should not be carried out strictly. You shouldn't extend rights to people who are not accustomed to self-government. And he said, like the Spanish race. That's why we had not yet given statehood to New Mexico, which he thought was a good idea. Only the Anglo-Saxon race had been prepared by centuries of discipline for self-governance. So America had to do justice to all the races, but it would be sheer cruelty to extend self-governance now to the Philippines or Puerto Rico. They're not capable. Governments must be by experts with a highly specialized training who can uplift them over time. And in his he was subsequently a contributor to this Harvard Law Review symposium. And in his argument, the status called the status of our new possessions a third view. Objecting to the view that the Constitution follows the flag, objecting to the view that the Constitution is irrelevant to the new colonies, he really laid out initially the distinction between incorporated and unincorporated territories with the argument that if a territory is unincorporated because people haven't been extended citizenship or Congress has not otherwise indicated incorporation, then the Bill of Rights doesn't follow in full force, then the Constitution doesn't apply in full force. And that argument was, he acknowledged, little known if not a novelty. In other words, he was basically making it up. He found a few little hints in Dred Scott, but he basically made it up for the explicit purpose of finding a reason that we didn't have to extend equal rights to the new colonies inhabited by races that he presented as unfit for equal rights. That really was the argument. It echoes through the Foraker Act debates, and it resulted in the Foraker Act, amongst other things, did say that citizens of Puerto Rico, it created the legal category of citizens of Puerto Rico who were not U.S. citizens, and that doctrine that they are citizens of Puerto Rico but not U.S. citizens was sustained in the insular cases. The results of these laws were to create, at the turn of the century, a four-part structure of American citizenship laws. There were those groups who were fully excluded from American citizenship and American territory, and this was increasingly Asians who were excluded. There were those who were governed as colonial subjects without access to citizenship, and that was the status of the Spanish and American war acquisitions, including Puerto Rico initially, and then American citizenship also embodied second-class citizenship for African Americans, many Latino Americans, and then finally full citizenship. And this structure was embraced in the insular cases with, as the language you've heard, Downs versus Bidwell speaks of an American empire accepting that there is an imperial structure to American governance. All this changed, but not so much. And I won't take time to go through all the features of it, but the Jones Act of 1917 imposed U.S. citizenship on Puerto Ricans. Most Puerto Rican leaders at the time opposed it, but it was done because in the World War I situation, the U.S. wanted to consolidate its claims and hold on a strategic locale. And the important thing about the Jones Act's extension of U.S. citizenship is that it means that Puerto Ricans, I would say to this day, have citizenship as a matter of congressional statute, not as a matter of the 14th Amendment constitutional guarantee of citizenship. Balzac versus Puerto Rico, as we've heard, said in any case, the fact that they were now citizens didn't change anything about Puerto Rico. It was still unincorporated. The Bill of Rights still didn't apply in full force. Subsequent Nationality Acts in 1940 and 1952 did say that Congress was proclaiming that Puerto Ricans were natural-born citizens of the U.S. and thereby eligible for 14th Amendment birthright citizenship. But those were still congressional statutes declaring that status. The Constitution was not interpreted by itself as creating that status. And so Puerto Ricans, I suggest, remain statutory citizens, not 14th Amendment citizens, and therefore a more vulnerable status. 1952 did see the creation of a kind of commonwealth status with greater powers of self-governance for Puerto Rico, but still with the Congress entitled to speak for Puerto Rico in external affairs, Congress entitled to decide what is an internal affair and what isn't, that Puerto Ricans on matters on which Puerto Ricans can govern themselves, and it's still a Congress in which Puerto Ricans do not have elected representatives with voting powers. And so I would argue that means that, yes, the legacy of the insular cases is very much in force. Puerto Rico remains a colony today, a colony that is more mildly treated and has tax advantages that make its situation much less oppressive than many colonies of the past, but still legally a colony. And Puerto Rican citizenship, which doesn't entitle people to full protection of the Bill of Rights in Puerto Rico and representation in Congress, Puerto Rican citizenship, as created by the Foraker Act, is still a status that was conceived in racism, expressive of the proposition that all men are not created equal, and supportive of a federal government that, in regards to Puerto Rico, does not derive its just powers from the consent of the governed in any regularly verifiable way. And so the kind of imperial colonial status created at the turn of the century has never been eradicated. What to do about it is a difficult question. It is a question that I believe the United States should leave to Puerto Ricans to decide for themselves, and they are closely divided. But as long as it survives, the U.S. remains an imperial nation. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm grateful to Lisa Perez for the invitation and to the Latin American Law Organization for the invitation to be here today, and to Professor Martin for his introduction, and to all of you for being here. I am going to be talking to you about my revisionist account of the insular cases So for those of you who just learned today what the insular cases are, now you have to forget all of that, because I'm going to tell you that they're about something else, although it's pretty related. It's all about empire in the end. What I'm going to do is just briefly go over the historical context. We've done some of that, so I won't spend a lot of time on that. And then briefly describe the standard account, which you've also heard, so I'll just recap it. And then I'll turn to my argument. So as you've heard, 1898, the U.S. defeats Spain in the Spanish-American War and annexes the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico, and takes control over Cuba. The annexation of these territories raises the stakes of the debate over empire that you've been hearing about. The question was, are these people American? Are they foreign? What do we have to do with them? Do we have to give them statehood? In the rhetoric of the time, the question was, does the Constitution follow the flag to these places? And that question encompassed all of these, as well as a constitutional question itself. Does the Constitution apply there? The debate came to the court in a dispute over a shipment of oranges from Puerto Rico to New York. Duties were charged on these goods, and the question in the case, which is Downs versus Bidwell, the most important insular case, as Judge Torruella mentioned, the question was whether imposing duties on a shipment of oranges from Puerto Rico violated the Uniformity Clause of the Constitution. The Uniformity Clause requires that all duties and imposts and excises be uniform throughout the United States, and so if Puerto Rico were part of the United States, the duties would violate the Uniformity Clause. So the question in the case came down to whether Puerto Rico was part of the United States after its annexation by the United States following the Spanish-American War. The scholarship on the insular cases has said that the answer that the court gave was no. Puerto Rico is not part of the United States. The Constitution does not apply there except for its fundamental provisions. In this paper, what I'm going to do is challenge that account. There's some truth to it, but I don't think it's entirely correct. I'm going to offer my revisionist interpretation, and then I'm going to talk about in what way that interpretation is significant, and there will be sort of two registers there, a historical one and then a political one that I'll focus on more. So before turning to that argument, let me just quickly give a few more details about the standard account of the insular cases. This idea that the insular cases withheld all but the most fundamental provisions of the Constitution. What is that about? What the insular cases were supposed to have done was to divide the territories of the United States, the non-state territories, into incorporated and unincorporated territories. That referred to whether or not the territory was incorporated into the United States. So incorporated territories were part of the United States, and unincorporated territories were not a part of the United States, even though they were subject to U.S. sovereignty. This was the distinction the cases created. This distinction came to be known as the doctrine of territorial incorporation, and it was supposed to have had two consequences. First, the entire Constitution applied in incorporated territories, whereas only its fundamental provisions applied in unincorporated territories. Secondly, incorporated territories were on a path to statehood, so these were all the 19th century territories. They were all on their way to statehood, whereas unincorporated territories were not necessarily going to be states. They could be held indefinitely as colonies. So these are the two consequences that scholarship has identified in these cases, a constitutional consequence and a political consequence, a consequence relating to the relationship of these territories to the U.S. So I agree that the insular cases distinguish between these two kinds of territories. There's no question about that. And I also agree that the insular cases facilitated American empire. There is no question about that. But I disagree with most of the rest of the account. I think the account goes both too far and not far enough. It goes too far because it overstates, significantly overstates, the degree to which the insular cases were a break with the past and the degree to which incorporated and unincorporated territories were different. I think that's been wildly overstated. It was wildly overstated by scholarship even at the time and has been subsequently. The difference was not so great, and I'll explain a little more why. And I think the account doesn't go far enough because while it is true that the unincorporated territories were not on their way to statehood, the more important aspect of the doctrine, in my view, was that the unincorporated territories could be what I call de-annexed. They could be separated from the United States even after they had become domestic territory even after Congress had begun to govern them under the Territory Clause, even as they had reached the status that in the past had been considered a way of becoming part of the United States, even before you were a state. So in the 19th century, territories were all part of the United States, as Judge Torruella explained. Even after all of those qualities applied to these territories, they could still be de-annexed, separated from the U.S. And de-annexation, I argue, was really the key to facilitating empire. That is, extending territory and projecting power was not only a piece of cake, but it was something that the United States had been doing forever, and exercising plenary power over territories was also something it had been doing forever. But letting go of places and, you know, pulling back, it wasn't clear that the U.S. could do that, and particularly after the Civil War, and I'll return to that aspect of it later. So de-annexation is really what these cases are about. So in the rest of my remarks, what I'll do is I will talk about what the I'll flesh out my argument. I will talk about what the insular cases did not do. Then I'll talk about what they did, and then I'll talk about why it matters historically and politically. So as I've said, the standard account has the insular cases creating this sort of extra constitutional zone. That's the phrase that one scholar has used to describe what they did. Congress now had extreme plenary power over the territories. It could basically do anything it wanted there as long as it didn't violate fundamental provisions of the Constitution. Those were never clearly identified, but was supposed to be some limited number of constitutional provisions. That was all that restrained Congress in the territories. So how does this overstate the case? Well, what I show in the article on which my presentation is based in huge amounts of detail is that throughout the 19th century, it was never really clear whether the Constitution applied to the territories. This was debated, as previous panelists have pointed out, in the context of slavery. It was a famous issue, does the Constitution apply to the territories or not? Does it follow the flag? But even after the Civil War, after Dred Scott said it did for purposes of protecting slavery, and then the Civil War sort of left Dred Scott in a questionable status, to say the least, after the Civil War, the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on territories was never really clear about whether the Constitution applied to the territories of its own force. And in the article, I go over this jurisprudence and show the ambiguity in the cases. And just to explain briefly where the ambiguity comes from, Congress always extended the Constitution by statute to the territories once they were annexed. So a territory was annexed, and Congress would say, you know, we hereby extend the Constitution to this territory. So when the Supreme Court would hold a constitutional provision applicable to the territory, it was often not at all clear whether what the court meant was the Constitution applies of its own force, or it applies because Congress, in this statute, has applied it sort of in effect. Some cases were explicit that this wasn't clear. That is, the court would say, well, the Seventh Amendment applies either because it's in this statute or because it applies of its own force. We're not sure, but the point is the principles in it apply. There were also cases that went sort of strictly one way or the other. So one case would say, yes, it does, and the next case would say, no, it doesn't. And what I show is that this flip-flopping was also occurring right up to 1901. So in short, whether the Constitution applied in the territories, not really clear, and there were some really good arguments that it didn't actually apply and that Congress had been extending it by statute. So when the insular cases come around, there's a lot of rhetoric in them about how the Constitution doesn't extend to these new territories, but it isn't all that clear how this is different, other than there's a lot more racist rhetoric. There have been plenty of racist rhetoric in the past, but here it was sort of concentrated. It was clear that the court wanted to think of these territories as somehow different because the whole population was thinking of them as different, but doctrinally wasn't really clear exactly what the break was with previous cases. The other thing that one notices when one looks at the insular cases more closely, is that they didn't really actually withhold all that many provisions when they did say some provision doesn't apply. So there were some cases that said X provision doesn't apply. For instance, the uniformity clause was one. But there weren't really that many. In fact, if you read articles on the insular cases, you'll see that people say the court withheld the Constitution from Puerto Rico. For instance, the right to a trial by jury applies. But if you keep reading these articles, it's always, for instance, the right to a trial by jury did not apply. There aren't really very many others. So there's the uniformity clause in Downs v. Bidwell, and then there's the export clause, which, when you read more carefully, it turns out didn't apply to any territory because they were domestic, so these weren't exports. And then there are the jury trial provisions. And, you know, this is not insignificant, but there aren't really, there weren't, you know, it's not the same as saying the entire Constitution doesn't apply. That's one thing. The other thing that I show in this article, again, in huge amounts of detail, is that those provisions that the court did say were inapplicable, it also said were inapplicable in incorporated territories or in states, depending on the provision. So I discuss a case relating to Alaska that came down a few years after the insular cases we've been talking about, in which the court held that the uniformity clause, it didn't say inapplicable, it said irrelevant under the circumstances, even though what was at issue was an excise under the uniformity clause, as the court said. It said, well, Alaska is an incorporated territory, sure, but the uniformity clause doesn't really get in the way of this tax for a bunch of reasons, including Congress's plenary power over Alaska. So there you've got one provision that didn't apply in an incorporated territory. So then that's not such a big difference. Export clause, same thing. Supreme Court decision said the export clause doesn't really apply to any territory. So that's the second clause that doesn't really distinguish the two kinds of territories. And then as far as jury trial provisions, what gets overlooked in the scholarship is that federal jury trial provisions didn't apply in states at this time either. And states, of course, were the most incorporated territories of all. I mean, they didn't have to be incorporated. They were the United States. But federal jury trial rights were, well, they were protected in federal court, but they weren't protected against state governments until much later. So here, too, the difference between incorporated and unincorporated territories isn't so clear. Now, it's important to acknowledge that Congress was functioning as a local government as well as the federal government in the territories. So you can't, it's not identical to the situation in states where the federal government was within its realm and the local government was the state government. Nevertheless, what Congress did in this case was sort of mirror the situation that you had in states where in local courts these federal constitutional rights were not necessarily protected. Whereas in federal court they were. There's no case that ever held that jury trial rights did not apply in federal court in Puerto Rico. The relevant cases concerned local courts. So even there, the difference wasn't so clear. So turning to what the insular cases did. When you take a closer look at the insular cases, and in particular at the opinion that set forth the doctrine of territorial incorporation, that was a concurring opinion by Justice White in the case of Downs versus Bidwell, what you see is that there's a great deal of emphasis on the importance of reserving the right to get rid of these places. And this, what I do in my article is look at language that has been overlooked by scholars. The case is long, it's tedious, so people don't focus on this so much. But there are numerous passages in which he talks about the importance of ensuring that Congress can get rid of these places, that we not incorporate them because if we do, then we've created an indissoluble bond, he said. He talks about the importance of Congress having discretion to release or retain the territories. This is how he explains his doctrine. So I review these passages in my article and argue that this is the main thing Justice White was concerned with, was not creating a permanent relationship with these territories that we could then not put to an end. Turning to why it matters, two contexts, and I will be very brief about one and very brief about the second. So the first is the historical context. This part I don't develop so much in my article. I just gesture toward it. And basically what I say is you can't really talk about the separation of domestic territory after the Civil War, and particularly so soon after the Civil War, without thinking secession. And in fact, in original, in my early drafts of this paper, I used to talk about secession instead of de-annexation until people complain too much that territories can't secede, only states can. So we won't go there. The point is that historically, what this makes one think about is the ways in which the shadow of the Civil War loomed over the debate over empire. My argument is that the fear of empire that is reflected particularly in anti-imperialist arguments at the time has a lot to do with fears of global expansion leading to some sort of global conflagration and dismemberment. The idea was, you know, if we're going to forge out and annex people of all kinds of different races, let's make sure we can get rid of them. And I found some language in contemporary articles that say this pretty explicitly and others that say it more suggestively. Let's make sure that it's constitutionally possible to get rid of these places before we get ourselves involved in governing places all over the world. So that's sort of how I end the article, gesturing at that argument. The other context, which I think is probably more of more interest to this group, the other context in which this my de-annexationist interpretation matters is Puerto Rican politics, and specifically the Puerto Rican status debate. And I will do as quick a job as I can of explaining that. As you've heard already, Puerto Ricans are basically divided in half over what their relationship to the U.S. should be. Their status is still not resolved. They're still in kind of a limbo. Roughly half of the electorate favors statehood, and the other half, roughly, favors some sort of the current relationship, which is known as Commonwealth status and is sort of in between statehood and independence. And then there's a tiny fraction of people who favor independence. Because that's a tiny fraction, what you've got is over 90% of the population is very concerned with the idea of a permanent union with the United States. This is something that to judge from elections and plebiscites, people care about a great deal, and most people in Puerto Rico want. So both sides sort of sell their status, statehooders and commonwealthers, sell their status in part as a way to ensure a permanent union with the U.S. Obvious how statehood does that, but how does Commonwealth do that? Well, Commonwealth supporters say Congress can enter into a can pass legislation so that the U.S. will enter into a compact of permanent union with the United States. We can have a compact that binds us. And in recent years, scholars who know the insular cases have taken to resorting to the insular cases for support for this compact theory. What they say is, look, the insular cases gave Congress license to do anything it wanted in Puerto Rico, as long as it didn't violate fundamental rights. They gave them complete plenary power. Congress can do anything there. The Constitution doesn't apply except for a few fundamental provisions. And if Congress can do anything in Puerto Rico, why can't it enter into a compact of permanent union without making Puerto Rico a state? Well, what I say to that argument is both that it is wrong and that it is perverse. It is wrong because, as I argue in the first half of the article, the insular cases did not empower Congress to do whatever it wanted in Puerto Rico. The insular cases held that a few constitutional provisions didn't apply, and they made clear that you could separate from Puerto Rico if you wanted to. That's all that happened there. So this idea that Congress can sort of do whatever it can think of in Puerto Rico is incorrect and has been sort of promulgated by an overstatement about what the insular cases did. And the argument is perverse because, in my view, the insular cases is the last place that you want to go to find a theory of permanent union. Why? Because what they held was that unincorporated territories can separate from the United States. This is not only doctrinally correct, but also normatively appealing, and I'll end on this point. Territories don't have representation in the federal government, even though federal laws apply to these territories. So if you're going to have territorial status, then the best thing to do is to have a status where the right to separate is preserved, because as long as you don't have federal representation, you ought to have the option to leave. So in my view, the theory of de-annexation is actually an excellent way to sort of implement the values of self-determination. If you're going to appropriate the insular cases in favor of self-determination, what you want to do is adopt a de-annexationist reading, because a place like Puerto Rico with no federal representation ought to have the option to leave as long as it is denied that representation. Thank you.